I'm David Schreiner Khan, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep us stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Phyllis Weiss-Hassero. Phyllis is the foremost workplace multi-generational expert, speaking with a cross-generational voice. She champions the power of cross-generational conversation and collaboration to solve the urgent problems of knowledge transfer, succession planning, and attracting and retaining clients and employees of different generations. Her newest book on generational challenges is You Can't Google It, The Compelling Case for Cross-Generational Conversation at Work. Phyllis is president of Practice Development Council, a business development and organizational effectiveness consulting and coaching firm she founded over 25 years ago. She's a frequent speaker and a columnist for Forbes.com, Next Avenue, Legal Executive Institute, and others. Phyllis is the founder of Cross-Generational Conversation Day and owner-manager of the Cross-Generational Conversation Group on LinkedIn. Phyllis, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks, David. I'm really delighted to be a podcast guest for you. And thank you for welcoming me. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. So, Phyllis, with your focus on cross-generational conversations, you have a fascinating niche for your business. Why is it that you've chosen this particular area?
Well, I think somebody had to. And I realized it was easy for me to relate and work harmoniously with people who were older than I was, who were younger than I was. And this was really from the very beginning of my career as an urban planner. I came out of school with a master's degree, and I actually did have older people than me in my early 20s working for me. And then, of course, younger ones. But I think it's essential that the different generations do understand each other, communicate, collaborate with each other. And this is more so crucial every day. We have so much divisiveness going on in this environment, you know, more so than when I started this focus a long time ago, more so than 4 years ago when I started Cross-Generational Conversation Day. So it's been a mission of mine. I know that there are a lot of people who find disconnects with people of other generations, and our businesses, our communities, and our world really is in a whole lot of trouble, more than we even realize, if we can't get everybody working together, being interested in understanding the perspectives and the worldviews of other generations.
What are you hearing from people in the workplace about the need for creating these kinds of cross-generational conversations in an effective way?
I think there's a lot of interest, especially from the younger people. They love what I'm doing. They really want to get involved in it. I mean, the challenge that I really have is from the people who are the decision makers and the ones that control the budgets. And, you know, any consultant will tell you that this happens in whatever they're consulting in. But there's an interest. They know there are these disconnects. They know there's frustration. There's a lot of stress, which comes from lots of things, but they're also feeling it among the generations. The question is how to get them to feel enough urgency to spend more than one shot kind of things and check it off their list. So I'm a congenital optimist and I just keep going. And, you know, there's a lot of progress in many ways. But as I say, I have a lot of confidence in the younger people who I have even seen doing grassroots kind of organizing and arranging these kinds of conversations or these kinds of meetings or the workshops and showing up and wanting to be involved.
Mm. Why do you think there's reluctance on the part of the decision makers who tend to be in the older cohort around doing something long term and on an ongoing basis to try to do a better job of creating the kinds of effective communications that will work well across generations?
It's something that they, you know, don't feel instinctively. It isn't something that they were brought into the workplace doing. They didn't see the need for it then. But there's so much time pressure on everyone. And the reluctance that I have gotten from some big companies, actually, not all, but it is letting their people attend something for more than an hour and take them away from their everyday responsibilities. So it's, in some cases, more than budget issues. It's time.
Right. Are there any particular ways that you have found that it helps the decision makers understand the importance of doing this kind of work?
Well, you know, I think what we all have to do and what I do is recite what the business case is, explain that this is not just making people feel good, but it's really affecting their productivity and profitability. You want to, you know, I have a list of 10 things. I'll recite 5 for you right now. For one thing, you want to avoid costly turnover. So if people are not feeling like they're getting the whole story, that they're having the relationships that they want to be getting in the workplace or in their work, it can be externally with clients and customers and alumni and donors, all kinds of external stakeholders as well. They don't want that kind of turnover. The other thing that they don't want is costly litigation or uncomfortable litigation. So that, you know, will grab their attention. But in terms of the positive side, you want to be able to attract and retain clients and customers of different generations. You want to be able to attract and retain employees of different generations or alliance partners, that kind of thing. Knowledge transfer is crucial, and we know that as much as the boomers are really in no hurry, well over 50% of them to retire and to leave, eventually, you know, they're going to. Everybody gets older all the time, even babies. And that knowledge that they have, and it's not just the things that you can put in a computer, it's the relationships, it's their experience about how to do things and how that works, what comes through these important conversations. So that's another thing. And in, you know, another one, so succession planning is another thing that's related to knowledge transfer as well. And branding, you know, people want to see that the environment is really conducive to what they're looking for. And that has to do with relationships and conversations.
Are there areas in which the way you work on these issues differs from traditional organizational effectiveness consulting?
Yeah, I would say that it's more of a focus on generational differences, similarities, what, you know, makes it all work. And my focus is external, being a marketing business development consultant for over 30 years, hard to believe. I'm looking at the external relationships with clients and organizations that I work with. as much as the internal ones. So it's not just how do we make our internal teams work better, because that's a very important part of it, but it's also the value and the necessity of attracting and, as I say, retaining, not losing, having wonderful relationships ongoing with your clients, your customers, your donors, your alumni, as they say, if it's nonprofits, so that you have that sustainable business. It doesn't happen otherwise.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a particular story from your own experience that might illustrate to our listeners the importance of cross-generational conversations, maybe starting with a particular challenge that you were facing, and kind of walk us through the example and what ended up happening as a result.
Sure. I'm going to start with really something from the start of my cross-generational focus, which was 20 years ago in 1997, as a consultant. And I do relate this story and many others in the book, You Can't Google It. So the challenge was that getting management, who was one or two generations above the junior partners and senior associates. This happened to be in a law firm. We did in several law firms and accounting firms. So in my work with professional firms on marketing and business development, I realized in those late 1990s that the young people were not getting the attention they needed because the senior people were too busy. So I started next generation programs for mid-level professionals to junior partners that I was working with. And just to, in a nutshell, and then I can go into details for you, this effort resulted in new marketing relationships, sometimes co-developing new areas of practice. And then I got senior management talking with the junior professionals in a special series of meetings so they'd understand what was expected of each other and engender trust and confidence, a couple of the 10 traits and skills that I talk about in the book. This was a revelation to senior management and really a success on both sides. So it started that these next generation programs I started and coached the more junior people to develop and present business plans for new areas of service. They had ideas and they looked at the marketplace in a different way than the more senior people because of who they knew, their relationships, what their friends were doing, what kind of industries, new kinds of companies that were being created. They also needed budgets, and then I got them to report to management and the rest of the firm on the results from their marketing outreach. So they got their budgets approved. They got agreement to meet periodically and share what the firm's strategy was, and having some input to that, which the junior people really had very little of before. And we got management to listen in much different way to the younger lawyers. And a few of them made partner after, you know, this year or so that I was working with them on it. Others were promoted first to counsel, and new practice areas were started.
And what kind of business outcomes resulted for the firm?
But as I said, they were getting more clients in new industries that they were starting to work with. Mm-hmm. And I learned some interesting lessons from, you know, you're feeling your way through it when you're doing it. And it's not necessarily that I had all of this planned out. I was listening. I was observing. That's what consultants do. And it became apparent how important it was to create a non-threatening environment for the conversations. you know, there are always fears. There are fears even in management. They may have been doing things that were working for them for a lot of years, but a lot of them really not so sure that's the only answer or the best answer. So we created a non-threatening environment. Everybody understood that their jobs were not depending on this, that they had some flexibility, some leeway, some allowance to try some new things. And then another lesson was what a difference it makes when the parties actually follow through on what they said they were going to do. So that creates a trust and empathy, and they learned each other's perspectives in ways that they hadn't been actually going out of their way to do before. And again, trust and empathy and perspectives are some of those traits and skills that I talk about.
Yeah, well, clearly you're dealing with human dynamics, which is quite complex. And I'm sure this is as much an art as a science. And I'm wondering, as I'm listening to you describe this particular scenario and how important a safe space is to talk, I'm wondering how difficult it might be to create a safe space in a high-pressure environment like a law firm.
Well, it is. But it also depends. I mean, you have places where, you know, cultures differ. And in many of them, despite what you hear and read, especially about some of the large ones that are so large that most people don't know each other, and the one that I gave the example of was a medium-sized firm. They, you know, had enough people that there could be confrontations and concerns. But in general, they were willing to listen. And at that time, I had been working with that particular firm and often with other firms for several years. So they had a lot of trust in me, and I had accomplished or helped them accomplish things. So over time, we had built that kind of relationship. And it is, you know, there has to be some patience and relationship building. A lot of these things can't be sprung quickly and expect things to change overnight. But if you don't have those relationships, it isn't going to happen.
Right. It's clear that the development of these kinds of external and internal relationships across conversations take a long time to develop, and they take time to nurture. And I'm wondering, in particular, in your work, how have you found the success to play out, particularly in small companies and even solopreneurial ones?
Well, the solopreneurial ones, and you mean really just one person?
Right. When I describe solopreneurial, I'm thinking about a business that is probably a professional service business of some sort, and there's one primary person who's delivering that service.
Mm-hmm. I understand what a solopreneur is. I just was wondering if you meant that they did have employees or, you know, something beyond a virtual assistant. And even there's a relationship, and that's got to be good. You know, you have to have really good support from that.
Right. Every person who's a solopreneur is likely to have some kind of support. They probably just don't have a full-time employee who right. is part of the service delivery.
Yeah. So, I think there, I always believe in sharing what's going on. And transparency is, you know, another of the hot buzzwords these days. And well, it should be. And it's happening in many, many circumstances. So it's interesting. It's something that I always did. And I mentioned earlier on when I in my first career as an urban planner, and I was starting out young, and I would share what was going on in the projects with our secretaries, with our junior staff, not even the professional staff, you know, which of course we shared that. But these people were older than I was. And I found an interesting thing, and I didn't really think about what I had generated before many years had passed. But I would tell them these things, and they preferred working with me than they did with a lot of the more senior people. Not that there was anything wrong with the senior people, but I let them feel some ownership, like they were really important to the process of what we were doing. And I think that's a very, very important thing that solopreneurs, anybody needs to do. So with whoever it is that they have for support, their alliance partners, their referral sources, all of these external stakeholders also, it's really important to do a lot of sharing. You know, a lot of people believe that knowledge is power and therefore they want to hoard it. That doesn't really work very well. It probably never did, but it certainly doesn't in this day and age when people really value transparency being part of things. And nobody can do everything they need to do all alone.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. So with that in mind, I wondered if we might turn the conversation to somebody else. And perhaps there's somebody you'd like to recognize who's done a really remarkable job at Smashing Plateaus.
One of the people that comes to mind to me is Karen Stacy. And again, this is in the legal realm. She has started Diversity Lab. And what she was doing even before starting Diversity Lab, she started programs within firms for getting women to return, whether, you know, they had left when they were pregnant, they had or were there for, you know, left to have children and stay with them for a while, to get the firms to take these very talented women back. And it's very hard for professionals after they've been out for a while to come back. So, they want to, and they can, educate themselves and all of that, but there's just a reluctance very often that's getting a little better for firms to take them in. So she had started these programs, which were very successful, and the women were, you know, went through training and they came back. And then she started hackathons with teams of women law firm partners and the law schools to come up with ideas to improve women's lives and their success as lawyers in firms. And prizes were given, and that was recognized. And they've done a lot of other things that, you know, I see that she, you know, more and more is being recognized for all kinds of things and getting grants to do it. So, you know, there was an obvious problem, and she kept coming up with new things and persuading to the firms, the schools, to support what she was doing.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that example. I wonder, what is it we can look forward to in the near future from you? You have a new book that has just come out. What's coming up?
Well, there are going to be lots of events around the launch of the new book, the new additional website with two new URLs. My long-term existing website, PDCounsel.com, is going to remain and be a great archive for lots of articles and other kinds of things. But for the book and cross-generational conversation, there will be two URLs, youcan'tgoogleit.com and crossgenerationalconversation.com. And two new services or activities that are also in development now. One of them is Legacy Makers Masterminds, and that is to help people as early as in their 40s focus on their legacy at work, what they want to be remembered for, and how they can make a difference, and doing it with other people to support each other and spark ideas. And I think it's very important to start that early. And I've found with the ways that I have worked with founders and management in their legacy and getting them to let go of control and let younger people come in and have more participation in management, that in order to make them feel secure and willing to let go, usually gradually, that you give them something or help them create something that they'll be excited to continue to do and to feel confidence in other people and to realize that they really don't want to screw up what they've spent all this time building successfully. So that's where that comes from. And the other thing is we'll be launching my authentic age assessment to help people more accurately view their own age and advocate for themselves for promotions, for keeping their jobs, for looking new jobs. That chronological age is just one thing. I don't even really believe in it in this day and age. I think you can throw out a number and you can't really create a picture of what all the people of that age are like. And so there are 8 other definitions of age that we have in this authentic age assessment to make it look at this from different points of view, including how you think other people are thinking about you and your capabilities. And very often people are their own worst enemies and have a lower esteem about that than other people hold. And if they need to really redefine themselves for other people, how to go about it so they can create something as a working document and plan for themselves.
In addition to the links that you've already mentioned, is there any other link you'd like to mention for people to learn more about you or follow you?
Well, I'd love for them to see my LinkedIn profile and connect with me, join the cross-generational conversation group on LinkedIn.
Well, you mentioned the other links previously, so we'll include those in the show notes as well. And I wanted to wrap up by thanking you for coming back on Smashing the Plateau and taking the time to talk about the focus around all of your work and in particular your new book. My guest today has been Phyllis Weiss Hassereau. Thank you again, Phyllis, for joining us.
My pleasure, David. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I love your questions, so it's always fun.